The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the NCRS, a New Year newsletter, from the NFB.org, a couple of articles on a series they're doing on the IEP process. Part two is by Chelsea Page, and part three is by Sharon Krever-Weisbaum, an attorney. From Bleeping Computer, we have articles on the blister malware that I didn't finish last week, and the red line malware that stole data. And the AFB has a New Year's message for you. And if I have time left, I will read an abstract of a study in the British Journal of Ophthalmology. So let's get started. From the North Carolina Reading Service, thank you. Write it on your heart that every day is the best day in the year, by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Happy New Year 2022. Welcome 2022. We have so much to look forward to in the new year. A new year, a new facelift for the studios. Thanks to a generous grant from the Cannon Foundation, we will begin replacing the soundproofing on the walls of all three studios, which still has the original soundproofing material from over 20 years ago. Our New Visions Gala will be back in 2022 after a two-year absence, and our gala committee will be hard at work in January to ensure this fundraiser is a huge success. And most importantly, we look forward to working with all our wonderful volunteer readers, board members, office helpers, gala committee, and tech gurus in 2022. We could not do what we do without you. Thank you and Happy New Year. Mileage letters available soon. Please let us know if you'd like to receive a letter for tax purposes confirming the number of trips you have made to NCRS during 2021. There will be a sign-up sheet in the cutting room, and letters should be available by February 1st, 2022. Tech tips and reminders. Please note, when pre-recording your program, please remember to use 6 digits for the date of your program, such as movie 010122 for movie January 1, 2022. While we update the online studio calendar to the best of our ability, please remember, if you have not signed up to use a studio, please call the office, 919-832-5138, to schedule studio time. Or please check the lobby calendar first and make sure there is not another volunteer scheduled for studio time, and write your name and time frame on the whiteboard. The list of Board of Directors is Greg Suggs, President, Iris Green, Vice President, Sharon Benton, Secretary, Jeffrey Johnson, Treasurer, Joe Austin, Jim Cronin, Marcy Gordon, Brandon Hare, Craig Hayward, Bryce Smith, Cynthia Spate, Jennifer Walker, past President George Douglas, co-founders Ben Eason, deceased, Dr. Ed Funghauser. Contact NCRS staff, May Tran, Executive Director, may@ncreadingservice.org. Missy Hollander, Production Volunteer Manager, missy@ncreadingservice.org. Janet Schanzenbach, Director of Development and Community Relations, janet@ncreadingservice.org. Thank you. NCRS would like to thank the Carry Oil Foundation for their continuous support and contribution to NCRS. A message from AFB 100. Thank you. The second century of no limits begins today. On behalf of everyone at AFB, I wish you health and happiness this year. You've helped us start 2022 with an outpouring of support and a successful matching gift challenge. Now the work begins anew in our second century of breaking down barriers so we can create a world with no limits for people who are blind or visually impaired. You can follow our progress on Facebook and Twitter and catch up on a healthy dose of our commentary on our blog. We have lots of interesting things to share this year, and we look forward to being in touch with more updates. Happy New Year, signed Kirk Adams and the AFB family. Posted on NFB.org by the American Action Fund for Blind Children and Adults, special issue, the Individualized Education Plan, IEP, Preparation and Planning. The first part is an article by Mary Noel Chamberlain. From the editor, Perhaps you are unclear about when your blind child should begin to receive instruction in orientation and mobility, O&M. Perhaps O&M instruction is included in your child's IEP, but you are unsure which goals will be appropriate. Mary Noel Chamberlain has compiled a bank of O&M goals for children and teens. By reviewing these suggested goals, you may get a clearer idea of what your child needs to learn on the journey toward independence. Mary Noel Chamberlain is a teacher of the visually impaired, TVI, and O&M instructor in Omaha, Nebraska. Sometimes it can be difficult to get an orientation and mobility goal onto the Individual Family Service Plan, IFSP, or IEP for a young blind child. Most school districts require an assessment by a qualified O&M instructor. Often, this person will first look at the child's eye condition, visual acuity, and/or field of vision. Then, he or she will conduct an evaluation. The instructor will evaluate the child's ability to know where he or she is within familiar and perhaps unfamiliar locations. The instructor will also assess the child's ability to maneuver from one location to another with or without using alternative skills of blindness. Focus will be placed on the child's skills and ability to maneuver. For example, does he bump into door frames, furniture, or people? Does she step on toys and other items on the floor? For babies and toddlers, only an ophthalmologist report is necessary to determine eligibility. Some O&M instructors are unsure where to begin when they work with toddlers or non-walkers. In fact, some O&M instructors choose not to work with toddlers or with children who have not learned to walk yet. However, some toddlers do not walk because of, well, it's uncertain what their reasons are. Let me tell you a couple of stories about former students of mine. The first story happened several years ago when I worked with a 3-year-old called Laura. One day, Laura, her 2-year-old sister, and her mother took a tour of the Iowa Department for the Blind. The girls rode in a double stroller at the beginning of the tour. Soon, little sister wanted out, but Laura was quite content to ride around, pushed by her mother. Somewhere in the middle of the tour, we visited the Aids and Devices Department. Laura was lifted out of the stroller so she could be measured for her own long white cane. As little Laura stood with her cane, she began tapping items around her. She found my feet, her mother's feet, the cupboard, the table legs, and so forth. Afterward, Laura did not want to go back in the stroller. Her mother returned the stroller to the car, and both girls walked for the remainder of the tour. The second story happened at the Virginia School for the Deaf and Blind. I had an 8-year-old there who did not want to walk anywhere. He had been carried or pushed in a stroller whenever his family needed to go anywhere. At school, however, he could not ride in the stroller, and we could not carry him. Sometimes he simply sat in the hallway or on the sidewalk until he was ready to take a step or two. This little guy was nonverbal, so he did not have a way to communicate about what troubled him. Soon after he arrived at the school, I gave this boy a cane to try. I showed him the basic way to arc the cane in front of his body as he moved forward. Thereafter, this little guy could not be held down. He walked proudly all over campus, his head up and his cane in front of his body. In 2011, I began to create an O&M goal bank. In the bank, I captured some ideas I could use when considering goals for my students. Every goal must be measurable, and it must have an end date. By no means is this goal bank a complete list of possible O&M goals, but I hope that it will give you some helpful ideas. As you read through the list, remember that it is only a selection of the countless goals that can be used for any particular student. Keep in mind that not all students are the same. Not all students work at the same pace or have the same O&M needs. The list is too lengthy to do in my show, so I will continue with part 2 of the IEP planning process. Homeschooling your visually impaired or blind child and the resources that may be available to you in your state. The examples referenced are New York State-based, so I will not read that part here. Part 3 by Chelsea Page. From the editor, Chelsea Page is a teacher of blind children who just earned a Master of Arts in Teaching Blind Students, TBS, from Louisiana Tech University. She plans to work with blind infants and toddlers to ensure that they get the services they need. She has taught several blind students remotely. In 2016, she was the recipient of an NFB National Scholarship. I was born blind, and I attended a school for the blind until the beginning of ninth grade. Though I learned Braille, there was still a serious gap in my education. At the school for the blind, I had very little exposure to technology. I had a Braille and speak that I sometimes used, but it wasn't adequate to meet my needs. When I was mainstreamed in ninth grade, I struggled through two computer classes. I did not have a teacher of blind students to teach me to use assistive technology. The instructor in my computer classes was eager to work with me, and he taught me everything he could, including keyboard shortcuts for navigating through various programs. However, he didn't know anything about JAWS, the screen reader I was using. Although I had attended a school for the blind, I had been taught that I was not really blind myself. To be blind meant that you couldn't see anything at all. I couldn't see as well as a fully sighted person, but that didn't make me blind. In 2006, my family and I attended our first NFB National Convention. During that life-changing event, I began to identify myself as blind for the first time. After I attended my first NFB convention, I was hooked. I got my very first note taker with a Braille display, and I taught myself to use it. In 2007, I attended the STEP program for blind high school students at the Louisiana Center for the Blind, LCB. Before I started college, I attended the LCB's adult training program. Through these experiences, I decided that I wanted to teach blind students and give back what I had been given. Today, I have the privilege of teaching assistive technology to blind students via distance learning. I share my personal story because I want to emphasize the importance of ensuring that your child receives adequate and appropriate services from an early age. Blind children need to know that it is respectable to be blind, and they must receive an education that allows them to compete on terms of equality with their sighted counterparts. Sometimes it is difficult to find a teacher of blind students who is qualified to teach the skills that your child needs, especially if you live in a rural area. In recent years, distance learning has had a huge impact on society. It has brought instruction within reach for millions of people who never before had such learning opportunities. Many teachers of blind students now provide instruction in Braille and assistive technology by using programs such as FaceTime, Skype, and Zoom. These are conferencing programs that allow both audio and video communication. Exploring the options. As a parent, you are the expert on your child, and you are his or her strongest advocate. If it is determined that your child needs instruction in Braille or technology, advocate for those services. Many school districts do not have access to a teacher of blind students who is proficient in these areas. In such cases, distance learning is a great option. When you or the school district find someone who can provide services, make sure that the teacher has a good, strong philosophy about blindness. Furthermore, be sure that the teacher is highly qualified in the areas which she or he will be instructing the blind student. I can say from experience that a blind child should not be pressured to use vision that may be unreliable and inefficient. Blind students should be taught to use non-visual techniques. Later, they may combine non-visual and visual methods to come up with a blend that best suits their needs. The teacher must have the confidence in the areas of instruction. If a teacher does not know how to use JAWS without constantly resorting to a mouse, he will not be able to teach a student to operate a computer efficiently using non-visual techniques. With the help of a qualified teacher of blind students, whether face-to-face or via distance learning, students can learn to navigate the course materials their classmates are using. Blind students may even learn to scan print documents, edit their scans, and emboss files into Braille. These skills prepare students for life after high school. However, students should not be expected to scan and emboss their own course materials, as the process is quite time-consuming. Technology plays a central role in today's classrooms. It is crucial that our blind students have the same access to technology that their sighted peers take for granted. The blind ninth grader should be doing whatever is expected from a sighted ninth grade student. This goal can be reached as long as the blind student's technology is accessible with a screen reader, such as JAWS, Window Eyes, or NVDA. It is extremely important for the teacher of blind students to keep up to date with the most current devices and software. Open lines of communication. If the blind child receives assistive technology training through distance learning, you may wonder how to make certain that all course materials are accessible. With an open line of communication, teachers and other members of the IEP team can ask you to preview materials, and they can assist in making those materials accessible. Good communication may minimize the need for a child-specific paraprofessional. With an open line of communication, the team can plan for the child's future needs and make certain that he has the proper tools in his toolbox. As long as all members of the team exchange ideas freely, the child can benefit from Braille instruction via distance education. Distance education allows our blind students to have the same opportunity to learn as their classmates, even if they live in an area with no qualified teacher of blind students. Final thoughts. In summary, make sure that the blind student receives the services he or she deserves. With today's technology, those services can be provided in a traditional classroom setting or through distance education. Advocate for your child to have a qualified and confident instructor to teach the necessary skills. Geography need not be a limiting factor. If a qualified teacher is not available in your school district, consider distance learning as a strong option. Keep an open line of communication with your child's team and discuss all of the topics related to her needs. By providing good services from the outset, the school can minimize the need for a child-specific paraprofessional, saving money in the long run. Over time, the child should be encouraged to advocate for what he or she needs. The ability to advocate for oneself is very important at every stage of life. Distance instruction is changing the educational landscape for everyone. By working remotely with a qualified teacher, blind students can receive instruction in Braille and assistive technology more easily than ever before. The fourth part of the article, of the Individualized Education Plan, Taking the Next Step, by Sharon Krever-Weisbaum in an interview. From the editor, when parents feel that they have reached an impasse with their child's school district, legal counsel may be their best option. In this interview, Sharon Krever-Weisbaum, managing partner of a Baltimore law firm, Brown, Goldstein, and Levy, discuss how parents can work with special education lawyers to achieve a positive outcome. Interviewer's name is Deborah Kent Stein. As an attorney, how long have you been involved in cases involving blind students? Have you noticed any changes in the kinds of cases that come to you over the years? Sharon Krever-Weisbaum. I started working on cases involving blind students in the early 2000s. My sense is that over the past 5 years, the barriers for blind students have changed, perhaps even increased, given the proliferation of a technology in the classroom, whether for homework assignments, testing, or for in-class online collaboration. Of course, we continue to experience school districts that are resistant to providing the level of Braille instruction that students need, resistant to providing orientation and mobility that ensures significant community integration, and resistant to ensuring that blind students receive timely, accessible materials, which of course makes equal access difficult if not impossible. Many times, the key is a strong teacher of students with visual impairments, a TVI, who understands that blind students can progress at the same level as their peers as long as they are provided with the right skills and equal access. Although it is not entirely different at the college level, there has been more litigation and more publicity regarding the legal obligations on institutions of higher education, which has prompted more progress than we've seen at the K-12 level. Interviewer, when things aren't going well, at what point should parents bring in a lawyer? Lawyer, when parents contact me, I usually start by asking some basic questions. I'll ask them, have you let the school know that you're unhappy? Do you feel that you're being heard? Have you documented your concerns? Have you brought a blind adult to the IEP meeting to talk about the importance of Braille and technology? The answers to these questions give me a sense of what is going on, how far things have gone, and where the process needs to go. Sometimes parents have been to one IEP meeting after another and nothing is getting done. One parent I worked with fought for 3 years to get Braille instruction for her son before a lawyer got involved. If the parents believe they are not being heard and that their child is losing ground, then it is time to bring a lawyer on board. Interviewer, are there times when you feel parents turn to a lawyer too hastily? Susan, at times parents call for legal assistance before they bring in an advocate, such as someone from the NFB. I recommend that parents take an advocate with them when they go to these meetings. Things tend to go more smoothly when an advocate is present. If parents talk about going to due process right from the start, the school is likely to get on the defensive, and communications can break down very quickly. Interviewer, how can parents find a lawyer who knows about blindness? Sharon, most special education lawyers are quite familiar with disabilities such as dyslexia and autism, but often attorneys have not handled a case involving a blind child. This does not need to be a concern. Part of our job as lawyers is to educate ourselves, no matter what the case involves. A lawyer with experience in special education law can educate herself about Braille, mobility, and any other blindness need that pertains to a particular case. Interview several lawyers and look for someone who is open to talking with the NFP and with other parents of blind children. In my work, I do a lot of consulting with other lawyers. I can be a resource for lawyers who are unfamiliar with blindness cases. When a child has disabilities in addition to blindness, the lawyer needs to learn about the intersection of the different disabilities. If your attorney is willing to learn about blindness, he or she can be a great advocate. Interviewer, how does the process work once a lawyer gets involved in a case? After meeting with the parents and the student and reviewing the most recent IEP, a lawyer can attend the IEP meeting and help the parties communicate with each other. A good lawyer is a good communicator. In a lot of instances, just having a lawyer at the table will turn things around. If the problem cannot be resolved at the table, the attorney will discuss the options that are available to the parents. Interviewer, can you say a bit more about that? Sharon, one option is to file a due process complaint. Another may be to file a complaint with the state's Department of Education. There may be options outside of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, which an attorney might consider, such as the ADA and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. If the family decides to file a due process complaint, the family can bring experts and witnesses to the hearing. A due process hearing can stretch out over a long period of time. The court may say it will take 8 days, but those days can be spread out over several months. Due process is very adversarial and stressful. It is also a very expensive process. If the parents prevail, however, they can recover a portion of their costs. If problems can be resolved at an IEP meeting, it's a lot less stressful and a lot less expensive. Interviewer, with all the downsides, have you seen situations when due process is beneficial to the family and the student? Sharon, absolutely. There are times when the pressure of litigation is the only way things will change. For instance, if a student who needs Braille instruction cannot obtain this needed service at the IEP table, I would, of course, encourage a family to go to hearing. Interviewer, recently the Supreme Court handed down a ruling on disability case in Michigan. What impact do you think that ruling will have on disability cases going forward? Sharon, the case involved a child with cerebral palsy who needed a service dog. The school refused to allow her to have the dog with her in the classroom. The family brought suit against the district under the ADA and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. The issue before the Supreme Court was whether the administrative exhaustion under the IDEA is required before bringing such claims of discrimination to the federal court. The Supreme Court held that exhaustion under IDEA is required when the remedy sought in the complaint is a denial of free and appropriate education, FAPE, but not if what is sought is something different, such as equal access and equal opportunity. Although this type of analysis will be very case-specific, we believe that the Supreme Court's decision will open up direct avenues to the Federal District Court under the ADA and Section 504, where what is being sought is access to equal educational opportunities. Another very important recent ruling from the Supreme Court will be helpful in ensuring that districts have higher expectations for our blind children. The Supreme Court recently rejected the barely more than de minimis progress standard that some lower courts had deemed sufficient to meet the FAPE standard. The court held that a child's educational program must be appropriately ambitious in light of his or her circumstances, and that every child should have the chance to meet challenging objectives. Interviewer, a lot of kids who have disabilities in addition to blindness tend to fall through the cracks. How can parents make sure these kids get the education they deserve? Sharon, when a blind child also has other disabilities, he or she often gets placed in a class for children with severe disabilities, and blindness skills training is often ignored. A failure to address the child's blindness obviously exacerbates the gap in learning. Parents must be sure that school districts are focusing on all of the child's needs, and they may have to request an independent educational evaluation if the parent's concerns are not being addressed. Interviewer, is there anything else you'd like parents to know? Sharon, I recommend that parents review two guidance documents issued by the United States Department of Education and the United States Department of Justice, and I suggest that parents' attorneys review them as well. There are two websites with hot links cited. Interviewer, thank you so much for your time. This is great information, and I'm sure a lot of parents will find it very helpful. From BleepingComputer.com, Have I Been PWNED? Adds 441,000 accounts stolen by Redline malware. Article by Lawrence Abrams. The Have I Been PWNED data breach notification service now lets you check if your email and password are one of 441,000 accounts stolen in an information stealing campaign using Redline malware. Redline is currently the most widely used information stealing malware, distributed through phishing campaigns with malicious attachments, YouTube scams, and Where's Crack sites, WAREZ/crack. Once installed, the Redline malware will attempt to steal cookies, credentials, credit cards, and autocomplete information stored in browsers. It also steals credentials stored in VPN clients and FTP clients, steals cryptocurrency wallets, and can download additional software or execute commands on the infected system. The stolen data is collected into an archive called logs and uploaded to a remote server from where the attacker can later collect them. Attackers use these logs to compromise other accounts or sell them on the dark web, criminal marketplaces, for as little as $5 per log. Redline logs publicly exposed. Last weekend, security researcher Bob Dyachenko filed a server exposing over 6 million Redline logs collected in August and September 2021. The threat actor likely used this server to store stolen data, but failed to secure it properly. Dyachenko told Bleeping Computer that while this data contained 6 million records, many had the same email address used for different services. This week, many LastPass received emails warning that their master passwords may be compromised, as they were used to log in from an unusual location. Dyachenko found that numerous LastPass credentials were stolen and stored in the exposed Redline logs, and checked various emails for LastPass users who received the emails to see if they were listed. Dyachenko told us that the server is still accessible but no longer appears to be used by the threat actors, as the number of logs has not increased. To make it easier for others to check if a hacker stole their data in the exposed Redline malware campaign, Dyachenko shared the data with Troy Hunt, who added it to his Have I Been PWNED service. Redline data contains 441,657 unique email addresses stolen by Redline that can now be searched on Have I Been PWNED. Unfortunately, if your email address is listed in the Redline malware logs, it's not enough to just change the passwords associated with that email account. As Redline targets all of your data, you must change your password for all accounts used on the machine, including corporate VPN and email accounts and other personal accounts. Furthermore, as Redline attempts to steal cryptocurrency wallets, you should immediately transfer the tokens to another wallet if you own any. Finally, if your email is listed as part of the Redline records, you should scan your computer using an antivirus software to detect and remove any installed malware. There are five related articles with hot links on the BleepingComputer.com website. I've run out of time to finish the article on BleepingComputer.com about the Blister malware that I started last week, so please go to that website to read the article. We've run out of time for this week's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next week. I hope you enjoyed it. Happy New Year. I'm Doris Hyde reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have a comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.